That's music from Stephen Curtis Chapman. The song's called Cinderella. 9 minutes after the hour, it's a Wednesday morning, and David Allen Punt is in the house. He's sitting there upright, looking sharp today, particularly sharp at the news desk today.
Well, thanks.
And Doug Greenwald joins us from Columbia, Maryland. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And a little political commentary, too, did you? You talking about an article you sent in to somebody. Do you have some gripes about the presidential campaign, do you?
Not necessarily,
no.
But my first observation is, how come you said David was looking sharp, but apparently I'm not?
No, well, you look good, too.
You're kind of in the dark there.
That's actually part of my contract, Doug.
Okay, there you go.
He has to say nice things about it.
Doug has spooky lighting in his office there. It's just, you know, it's like you don't want to hold a flashlight under your chin and you go,
well, let me turn something else on here and get what the photographers would call backlighting.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, that's better. Oh, I like
now
it.
Now we're talking.
You've got shelves filled with books just like David does there, except I'll bet you read yours.
Well, but mine's not wallpaper like his.
That's true. This helps with David's image, so it's important
we
have that.
You can get those books, you know, for I think it's $16 a yard.
Mm-hmm. You know, when your county museum closes out the basement $1 bookstore, that's where you can pick up a lot of inventory.
Oh, yeah, a lot of stage props there for you. So, okay.
Well, you wait. You know, the library has a used book sale every year, and you wait until the last 5 minutes, and then you go in and you can fill a shopping basket full of books for a dollar and a half.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's where all the good
I'll
books
are. I'll give you a buck and a half for the whole bunch. How's that sound?
Talk about a bargain. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking.
Yeah.
Now anyway, regarding your
question
or comment about current political realities, I mean, I think I'm, like a lot of people, just find myself between a rock and a hard spot. And I was, you know, musing the other day, what's the compare and contrast here? If I had to vote, how would I vote? I still can't answer that question. Mm-hmm. But one of the pundits in the D.C. area here who comes out and, you know, spreads his observations on a weekly basis, I emailed him, I won't say the name, and he's a Christian, by the way, mm-hmm. which is the only reason I would consider sending an observation to him. I said, John, his name's not John.
Okay.
Here's my dilemma. Should I consider supporting a person who seems to trash the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes just about every hour of every day? Or should I support a political party who is changing God's laws?
Mm-hmm.
i.e. as regards marriage and human sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of those is a preferred outcome. So I asked him, I said, which is worse? Trashing the Sermon on the Mount or changing God's law? And he said, that's a really good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim was all kerflumped this morning about Judge Curiel and the whole little tempest in a teapot that is being whipped up now. And, you know, they said the hidden meaning behind that is that there is good news that this guy who is bigger than life, who is making these supposed mistakes, is that he's drawing attention to some very important issues in this culture that we've got, like being afraid to speak, there's this politically correct notion that there are certain things you can't say, and maybe he's not as erudite as you are, for example, or as Jim is, but there are important stuff that's going on behind the scenes that are almost as important, probably more so, for the future of the country, that have to do with, you know, the very basic foundation that we were created on. We have freedom of speech in this country. We should be able to say any darn thing we want to, as long as you don't harm anybody else. But you're going to get hounded out of town on a rail if you do. Nobody's taking them to task. But anyway, I digress.
Well, yeah, my point was that Mr. Trump fires from the hip and is incautious and not too judicious in what he fires out there. And I think his real self is somewhere behind all that. That what you hear from him and how it gets interpreted and blown up in the press is not necessarily him. So in a sense, I'm defending him, although I wish he wouldn't do that, you know? like a more reasoned approach to these things. I want to hear about policies. I want to hear, you know, but these little side kerfluffles, that's a good word for this. It's just distracting. And I'm not sure it's helpful in helping the rest of us choose who we're going to vote for.
Now, the time I'll have one more piece, Doug, and then I'll let you talk because you didn't come here to listen. You've got some things to say. But I'm trying to remember the last time I had a clear-cut, casting concrete, a positive choice between the people that are running for the highest office in the land. And I'm not sure if I can. I guess I'd have to go back as far as Reagan. It has always been the choice of the lesser of two evils, to me. And it's, yeah, I've got a little bit higher standard of, you know, whether or not I want to follow this particular person or not. I mean, there's so many people that I have no idea how they get to this level.
Yeah, in the old days, which is maybe 30 or 40 years ago now, if you had some concern about a candidate, you could at least look to the party's platform. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, this is their principles. This is what they stand for. This is what they at least say they want to try to do. And there's some comfort there in the final selection process. But at this moment in time, I don't know what the Republican platform is going to look like when it comes out of Cleveland. And I have no idea whether Trump has any interest in endorsing it or not. So, you know, even the old paradigms of how one made a decision or tried to make a decision has sort of been rendered obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
Or and, very uncertain.
And we also have to understand that we're different people now than we were 30 or 40 years ago. And maybe this we see things more clearly now. You know, we can't say it was Disneyland 30, 40 years ago and all was right with the world. But I think maybe we're a little more attuned to the things that are going on behind the scenes here now.
Yeah. It may well be. I think the only thing that my wife and I take solace in at about the beginning and the end of every day here is the King of Glory is still firmly in control.
Yeah.
Psalmist says the kings of this world rattle their swords and count their chariots, and the Lord but laughs.
Yeah. You're involved in a number of uphill battles. Preserving Bible Time has been around for what 15 years now, and I'm just hoping you've made a huge dent in American evangelicalism. I don't know that that's a fact. I know you keep beating your head against the wall. You have important things to say, and I'm hoping there are lots of people listening. You've got some new tools in the bag that you're working
well, on. You know, pushing a rope uphill, you know, sort of comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of making a dent in Western evangelicalism, no, I don't think so. Maybe a small pimple, but, you know... To a dermatologist, he'd be hard-pressed to try to find that pimple somewhere on a human body.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ministry to the remnant. I've said that for a decade now, and I take solace in that because in the greater sweep of church history, a lot of what God has done has been working through remnants, not through mass movements.
Mm.
And the call is simply to be faithful to the vocation that's been placed in front of you, which to me is to teach the scriptures as best I can in its original context, and, you know, cast that bread upon the waters. And the return on investment on that is really not up to me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I suspect this ministry is sort of in the iceberg phenomena, and that is whatever impact might be evident above the waterline is only 10% perhaps of the impact it's had, but you can't see it because it's below the waterline. But
well,
anyway.
There's something that you've kind of hinted at in previous conversations, something called the Institute for Biblical Context. And that sounds like such a promising thing. That's teaching to pastors, isn't it? That's creating a nucleus of contextual thinkers.
It is. And to go back to how you opened this up, I've often asked myself, how can you make a dent in Western evangelicalism? And to answer that question, which I've tried to answer, in fact, I'm in the midst of answering, is to do a diagnosis. Any good doctor will tell you that 90% of an effective therapy is rooted in a sound diagnosis. Trying to come up with solutions without a diagnostic plate in front of you, whether it's a blood test or MRIs or CAT scans or whatever all these other diagnostic tests are, you're just guessing. And so as you look across this little piece of the world here called biblical context, and that's the people who care about biblical context and the people who teach it and the people who try to propagate it, one of the things you realized is that this little field of biblical context is completely balkanized. It's fragmented. It's all broken up into pieces. So, you know, you can find a world-class expert in archaeology, and that person may be absolutely clueless about the linguistic, literary, contextual issues of the biblical record. And the same would be true vice versa. You can find somebody who's really good on biblical geography, for example, and they really don't have much of a working knowledge about biblical culture. And so you've got all these pieces out there, fragments, and they all teach or write or speak in their area. But the real problem is, to do justice to a passage in Scripture, you have to draw upon 13 to 15 different aspects of biblical context and then integrate those pieces together to retell the narrative as it was meant to be understood in its original setting, okay? That's the task. Let's simplify that and call the quest for original meaning. Now, in addition to being balkanized, all the people who have pieces of expertise here tend to be lone rangers. They don't interact with each other. Most of the time, they don't even know each other exist. And if they do, they tend to avoid them. Why? Because a lot of people who have developed some area of expertise in biblical context end up taking trips to Israel and leading tours, study programs. And if everybody is interested in trying to make some money off a study program, then the other people in this Bible contextual world could be viewed as competitors. Maybe they have a better trip to Israel and you'd lose some of your traffic over the years. So you got all these kind of issues going on. And it's troublesome. Now, I try to be as ecumenical as I can, and we can even argue to what extent that exists, but I long to interact with other people in the world of biblical context so I can learn. The issue of continuing education is a huge one here, because most of the people who are these lone rangers, who are these experts, have probably been exposed at best to one major teacher of biblical context in their past, okay? And so they have one view of the subject, one slant, one perspective. And yet biblical context is like a diamond. It's got many facets that comprise the whole. And I've always wanted to be exposed to many different facets of understanding of other people's expertise as I can. And that's really hard to do. There is no natural forum for that to take place. There's no natural meeting. There's no natural podium. There's no natural institute where you can sort of try to do this sort of thing. And as a result, the little teeny industry here called biblical context remains full of Lone Rangers, balkanized. And that's a real issue. Because most of the people who are experts, as I said before, have been exposed to one prior expert in the area that they're now carrying on that expertise. But that the expert that they learned from may have had a certain kind of spiritual gift mix, which would say, let's just say they had the spiritual gift of knowledge, but not the spiritual gift of wisdom. Therefore, they've learned from an expert, quote unquote, who is strong on the facts, but is weak on the insights and the applications. Or the vice versa experience could have occurred. Could have spent a lot of time with someone with the gift of wisdom who wasn't that strong with the spiritual gift of knowledge. And so you got all these different issues. And then you have, from the expert that the experts learn from, a particular slant that they have because they may have gotten their PhD in archaeology. Well, guess what kind of slant you're going to get? You're going to get an archaeological slant to biblical context. You're going to learn a whole lot more about rocks than most people would ever care to know. And if you spend your time learning from a linguist, guess what slant you're going to get on it. But again, there are multiple facets to this wonderful world of biblical context. And so I've long mused, and it's actually been on our website for over a decade, about something called the Institute for Biblical Context, where the faculty, once a year, twice a year, would get together for a week somewhere at a venue, and we would teach for 3.5 or 4 days on different aspects of biblical context. So the better part of one day might be on geography. The better part of a second day might be on biblical culture, might have a half day on literary forms and issues and contextual restoration. And the same would be for the historical backdrop. And then we'd even break that apart. You know, geography can be in historical geography as well as physical geography. Physical geography, the geology, the rainfall patterns, the topographical issues, the valleys, the trade routes, all of that's physical geography kind of stuff. And so there would be a place to go where there'd be 6 or 7 teachers for that week, and you'd be exposed to all aspects of biblical context, and you could also see these experts do passage development. In other words, how do you tie all this together and recreate the original narrative to do a better job of discerning the original meaning? That's been my dream for a decade, to be actually able to do that. And through some remarkable providential happenings in the last 30 days, that actually may be getting ready to happen in the summer of 2017. And in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be going to the Midwest to talk with a group of people about actually pulling this off and what who the first faculty ought to look like. And we've got a venue sort of in view here and some topics that we're working on. And that's occupying an awful lot of my interest these days. I just put together a 9-page concept paper for what this Institute of Biblical Context would look like. You know, it would be for both pulpit and the pew. The emphasis to the pew would be how to read between the lines. You know, there may be a short encounter that's just 38 words long in Scripture, but there are 3,000 words of assumed contextual understanding between the lines. And for the pastoral types who wonder if this is going to have enough weight or gravitas, substance, meat, we would use the phrase integrated contextual exegesis, which is what it is. Exegesis is discerning, discovering the original meaning of a passage, and integrated context is about the best way I know of to sort of cause that to happen. And so that's part of my personal excitement these days. And after 10 years, I can actually say I found a group of people who are equally excited about that as I am and actually want to try to pull it off. So that's where it's at on that one.
I'm just thinking, how does this relate to training in seminaries? I could see this a few years down the line being an adjunct to the syllabus for at least various seminaries, if not many. But this context is something that's not routinely taught in seminaries, is it?
Well, you know, it's a question, definition of terms. Most seminaries would say, well, of course we do, but it's what they mean by that. Mm-hmm. Typically, in a seminary setting, context means Greek and Hebrew. So they'll spend a whole year on each of those subjects. That's an aspect of the literary context. What is the word meaning? Then the second piece of their meaning of context is historical context, which means the Old Testament. Well, yep, that's for sure. And then the third piece of their contextual understanding is, I'll call it Judaica, the umbrella under which you have the Jewish view of things, the feasts, the festivals, and all the aspects of Judaism in the first century. That's what 95% of most seminaries consider context to be. Well, that's three of the 15 categories of context, but a lot of stuff gets left behind that way. So to answer your question, if you really want to dream, once or twice a year, the Lord willing that we're able to offer and actually pull this off, I would shut down every seminary within 500 miles of where we're having this event for a week and bus in all of my seminary students and let themselves get immersed in this experiential thing called biblical context. And I'm going to guarantee you it would change forever the way they approach the scriptures.
If you can get them through the door, because it's natural, as you've discovered over the years and related to us, you meet resistance frequently and continually with this.
Well, that's true, and this is the whole issue of paradigms. And I've written before on this issue of we're all prisoners of our paradigms, and crashing through existing paradigms of how seminarians are trained is probably the most difficult task in the world. There are lots of paradigms that go way beyond biblical context. I mean, challenging the status quo is the hardest thing to do in a church. This notion of continuous improvement, let's take out a fresh sheet of paper and completely rethink what we're doing, it's just a foreign notion to a church, probably to a seminary as well. And so the very things we're used to doing in business organizations, in what used to be called total quality management in the 90s, root cause analysis, commitment to continuous improvements, autopsies performed after every major program and event to see how we could do it better. It's like that's a foreign land when you walk into a church. And so that's the challenge. The church is just frozen in time in a lot of paradigms, one of which is seminary training, pastoral preparation. But there are other paradigms we're locked in. We're locked in, most churches are still locked into a 19th century missionary paradigm, missions paradigm. We're locked into a primitive view of adult Christian education.
Now, is there a place, a facility, an institution that's going to help you out with this? Will you be centered someplace, this institute?
Yeah, there's actually a church with 2,800-seat auditorium with lots of breakout rooms and other kind of rooms that seems to be willing to host this thing. And I'm going to be checking that out in a couple of weeks. But if not, we have some other contacts in that part of the country and some other open doors that may be available to us at all. So I think a facility is clearly in view. I think a potential faculty is clearly in view. Whether and who will respond to it over time, that's in the Lord's domain. The Spirit will have to move in that way. We'll publicize it as best we can. But that's exciting, because that's something that's never been done before. And what excites me about it is the interactions between the faculty. You know, I would like to get the whole faculty together a day ahead of time and say, just share how you came to be in this world of biblical context. Mm-hmm. And then on another part of it, teach the rest of us your two favorite biblical passages in context. Let us learn from you. Iron sharpens iron. And so, you know, we can have the greater level of the iceberg going on here, where the public is being enriched, pastors in the pew, but there'd also be this area here behind the scenes where the faculty is enriching each other. And that to me is extremely exciting, because selfishly, there's a whole lot more things I still need to learn and comprehend and get on top of. And I'd love to be able to absorb some of the wisdom that others have accrued, and at the same time share what little I've picked up along the way for their benefit.
Well, I'm encouraged by this. I mean, this should be exciting, because I've seen what you leave in your wake, Doug. You've been up in our neck of the woods a couple times, three, four times, and I've seen church congregations just light up after you pass through with your Bible Live weekend seminars, and they get a taste of context, and they say, we want more. And there aren't many places they can turn to get it in the depth and in the detail that you provide. Are you going to continue to work with churches around the country individually?
Oh, absolutely. And presumably this will open up hundreds of more doors. Because as pastors, the Lord willing, you know, invest a week in this and travel 400 miles and get excited about it, they'll want to share that with their congregations. And that could well bring a whole new level, an order of magnitude increase in churches willing to invite any of the faculty in to further share the depths and riches of biblical context.
So the Institute of Biblical Context would become a resource for churches all across the country then.
Absolutely. And you touched on something which I didn't mention, but if you get excited about biblical context, let's say you've attended one of our Preserving Bible Times weekend, 9 out of 10 pastors who actually will come to these events will say this. I mean, I can predict it. Where has this been? Why was I never exposed to this? Where can I get more? And that's the question that needs to be answered. Mm-hmm. Where can I get more? The only conclusion so far about where can I get more, only two conclusions. I can read books, but those are books written from balkanized people. I talked about that before. Mm-hmm. Or you can go to Israel for a 10 or 12 day tour of Israel. And that's what most people think is the only option available to them. And I want to say to them, hey, going to Israel is great. Don't misunderstand me. But don't think that's the end of it. That's the kickoff. That's the appetizer. We can actually teach you more in the States in a more efficient, compact period of time than you could ever get exposed to in Israel. So that's the alternative that we have to have. We have to approximate the totality of the Israel experience here in the United States and therefore allow many more people to get exposed to the reality of biblical context who will never get to Israel.
Tell us about the Teacher in Residence program. What does that entail?
Well, this is another corollary of the same issue. I mean, you're familiar with typically how Preserving Bible Times has functioned over the last 15 years. We get invited into a church, and they get all excited about biblical context, and then we leave. And we spend 48 hours with them, maybe 72 if I bring the Sunday morning message. And then we might get invited back 18 months later. And then again, we might get invited back 2 years after that. Well, that's kind of hit and run for me. I like teaching to people where I can build a relationship with them, where something can sink in and then a little while later we can review it and flesh it out some more or clarify it some more or refine it some more or build on it some more. And so I have long desired, particularly as I get older and older here, to not have to get on airplanes and rental cars, you know, every other weekend and haul boxes and set up book tables and all that sort of thing to have a teaching weekend. Wouldn't it be nice to have to go to a church and stay for several weeks? Teach every Sunday, teach every Wednesday night, maybe teach something on every third weekend. Go and spend time with the life groups, the small groups. Visit with the staff. Do one-on-one tutorials with those in the church who might be teachers or youth directors, you know, who want to do a more dynamic portrayal of the Jesus stories that they tell to their kids. It can go in all kinds of directions, but then you can develop relationships and then come back every year for that same several week experience and further build on that relationship. That is certainly much less wear and tear on my body to be in one place for several weeks as opposed to getting in and on off airplanes around the country every weekend. And so I've long dreamed of that, and the Lord has finally blessed that dream. And we're actually going to do that in Frisco, Texas in January and February next year.
Oh,
going to be at the Frisco Bible Church.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited about that. That's in North Dallas. And on the other off days during the week when I'm not doing some teacher in residency stuff at the Frisco Bible Church, to actually go to some other venues and some other churches and to establish relationships with them as well, and always do that without having to get on an airplane.
Now, how big a group can you work with there? I mean, I'm wondering if this Frisco Bible Church would maybe invite, you know, the other congregations to join them in the effort, or does it get out of hand if you have too many people?
Well, I'm fleshing out some details with them where I hope we'll be able to do one or two public events on the weekends.
Okay.
And I've got some networks and other churches there in the North Dallas area that these would be community-based events on the weekends, although they'd be probably church-focused events more during the weekend on Sundays. But, you know, I'd have lots of time available for lunches and morning Bible study groups that I could attend or be a part of or be a resource to. I don't know all the implications of that, not having done it, but that's another exciting thing on our horizon.
The next thought that occurs to me is that's going to wear you out.
You think so?
Well, I hope not, but that seems to be inevitable. I mean, that's an intense, in-depth, lengthy presentation in your part. I would pray for you for the energy and the passion to continue that way, because to me that would be a very sapping sort of thing.
Well, I'll
thinking
let
of you,
you know
personally
when it's
now,
done.
Yeah,
but yeah. One of the things that I think you've noticed as well is that teaching God's word in context is also oxygen to me.
Yes.
It invigorates me. It excites me. It energizes me. And particularly the opportunity to build on relationships in a church setting.
It helps me sustain
time to teach context and to equip people rather than having just a short weekend exposure. Mm-hmm. I almost had the reverse thought on my mind. What am I going to do with all the hours in the day? I'll be sitting around a lot. But we'll see how it works out.
Well, I'm thinking, too, of all the resources you've built into Preserving Bible Times. It's a wonderful website, and anybody interested can link to the Preserving Bible Times website from our homepage there. It's preservingbibletimes.org. And there are things you can buy there, books and DVDs, and there's a free monthly reflection newsletter that really is more than monthly now that Doug puts out, comes to you via email, doesn't cost you a penny, and will light up your day. There's so many things that you can do on your own to help get you into this historic and cultural context of Scripture. In addition, Doug, you still got trips to Italy planned, do you not?
We do for next year.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see how that goes. One of the things that's happening right now worldwide is travel is really down.
Mm.
I just heard about some people that just come back from Israel. They were the only group on Temple Mount. I mean, that's unheard
really?
Of.
Mm-hmm.
I sourced some topographical maps out of Israel.
These are security issues?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorism.
Yeah.
Violence. And, you know, there's these random stabbings now is the latest wave of resistance in Israel. And even though I'd go over there tomorrow and be safe, feel and not only be safe, but feel absolutely safe, a lot of people don't view it that way. So we've actually had to cancel our Turkey trip.
Oh.
And we'll see whether these other trips get off the ground next year or not, because you have to have at least 25 people sign up to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, the response to our trips has been way, way down, and that's the reason why. Travel to Turkey is way, way down. Travel to Israel is significantly down, and it's even had some ripples. People are just not into traveling so much to Europe. Even Italy, you know, that's where all the immigrants are hitting the beaches in southern Italy. It has nothing to do with our trips, but again, it's the perception, it's the feeling. It's the ambiance of the whole Middle Eastern European dynamic right now that's just got people a little bit hunkered down.
You know, it was almost like you had this in view 20 years ago when Preserving Bible Times photographed Israel from the air and created a DVD series. So you can really, in effect, tour Israel from your living room.
Well, and that's why we put together our Bible Alive weekends and our Bible It's Land and Culture weekends and the Last Days of Jesus teaching weekend, so that we can recreate the Israel on-site experience and never leave the church.
Hmm. Institute for Biblical Context, teacher in residence program, lots going on at Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, speaking for me, I'll pray for you, and because this is important work, and I've seen how it lights up a Christian's understanding of what he reads day to day in the Bible, and that's too precious to just take for granted. So more power to you.
Great.
Doug, you know, maybe this is part of what you're thinking about and part of what the Institute will bring about and part of what the next step will be. But is there another generation coming up? Is there someone to pass the baton on? Now, I know you're going to live to be at least 150, maybe 200. But, I mean, the realistic notion of it is that there's only so many hours in the day and so many years in the life, and who's the next generation? They appeared yet?
That is a wonderful question. That was also one of the prime motivators that I didn't even mention in the opening to this subject. Mm. But for the last 3 years or so, I've been asking myself, how can I pass this along? Mm-hmm. How can we institutionalize biblical context so it doesn't die off with the current generation of contextualizers who are all 65 years or older? And a place where the younger generation can come and get inoculated with it, if you will. And so that's part of the desire of the Institute for Biblical Context as well. It would allow a number of us who have been more singular ministry oriented to institutionalize this notion as well as its content. Because one of the distinctives that Preserving Bible Times has done is create frameworks. Won't go into that now, but you're familiar with that. Mm-hmm. Frameworks for how to study the Bible in its context, the framework for how to make disciples. And I personally would like to have those frameworks institutionalized, kept, maintained, taught every year, long after I'm in glory. And this might be an opportunity for that to happen.
And of course, last week you told us we just lost Kenneth Bailey, who might have been the premier teacher of culture in the world. And so that's got to be on our minds too. Biblical, historical, cultural context, just a huge topic and something that really is key to understanding who you are as a Christian, what you ought to be doing, and how you grow. And Doug mentioned discipling. We haven't used that word much here recently, but that's what it boils down to, is what is a real disciple and how do you become one? How do you pursue being more and more like Jesus every day? Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times, thank you very much. Important time together today.
Thanks, guys.
We'll see you next week.
Shalom, thanks, Doug.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Shalom.